The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
you know, today is my favorite American holiday because of celebrating Martin Luther King. And and I wanted to, since the beginning of the year, do what I usually do at the beginning of the year, is to talk about the core teachings of Buddhism, out of which all of Buddhism comes, which is the Four Noble Truths. And these are the Four Noble Truths that are the insights, what is seen. Sometimes it's actually called the vision of freedom, of how to become free. And you know, it's what Martin Luther King was championing, was freedom for people here in the United States and abroad as well. And he was a person who, you know, on the surface was thinking he focused on, you know, political freedom, external freedoms, people to feel unafraid in their life, to have a life where they were unafraid of their children, what would happen to their children, because the rather than their children being raised in situations which was threatening even to their lives or threatening them to poverty, it was a life where their children could be raised and with possibilities and justice. And so it's easy to see Martin Luther King as being about kind of external, but he pointed, I think, to some phenomenal capacity of the human heart, of the human mind, in being an apostle of nonviolence. That, I mean, that's really, I think, one of the reasons why we have a holiday. And it's, I don't know if it's anybody else in the world who's, except maybe in India they have holidays for Gandhi. But for someone who's, you know, really stood out as a champion of nonviolence, to have that celebrated is quite something. And he, I think he understood quite well that in order to fight or struggle in a nonviolent way, it required a lot of from the heart, from the inner life. Something had to be very different in there than how the heart, the mind is, usually operates. I met on a retreat many years ago now. I was teaching a retreat, and this woman, the retreat, told me her story of the civil rights days, of going to the South to be part of a protest for civil rights and standing on a street corner with another group of other people protesting. And these white, I suppose, racists came along in a pickup truck and jumped out of the pickup truck and beat them up. So the next day, she told me, they went back and stood the same place. And the same people came and beat them up. It must probably wasn't so bad. I mean, it was, that they could come back the next day, but I'm sure it was bad enough. Then she said the third day, they were standing there, and the same people came along in the pickup truck and jumped out, and one of the same men who had been punching them out before stood above her with his fist, ready to hit her in the face. And their eyes met, and he looked into her eyes, and he said, "What are you doing? What are you doing? You know, 3 days in a row showing up so I can beat you up." And she explained, and that was the end of the violence. And there was a kind of meeting of those two, and they had a discussion and talk. And I don't know what the long-term consequence was, but to have the ability to stand there and receive this level of violence and not retaliate, to be willing to go back again and again, I think requires a tremendous amount of inner strength and something inside that has to change. And I think Martin Luther King and his, you know, people he worked with, part of what they did was prepare people and get them ready for this inner change that had to happen. And he talked about in his famous speech, "I Have a Dream" speech, about the redemptive value of undeserved suffering. I'm not a champion of undeserved suffering, that we should go looking for it. But the idea that it would be redemptive in certain circumstances, or the idea that it somehow be transformative in certain circumstances, is quite a phenomenal teaching in a world where people often run away from their suffering or want to deny it or attack other people or do something. But what does it take to be able to be willing? I mean, what he meant was that people are willing to march and have dogs attack them and bullets and shoot. And I knew people who were threatened with lynchings in the South. Horrible time. And what is it to stand up against that with tremendous inner resolve to transform and change something deep inside? So the freedom of Martin Luther King, it must have been both external political freedom and deep internal freedom, spiritual freedom, some kind of liberation. And I believe that, and if you look at Buddhism, it would seem on the surface that primarily it's internal freedom, this inner freedom of the heart, spiritual freedom. But I believe that that inner freedom translates to external freedom, translates to an external expression into the world, which I think is quite, hopefully, is revolutionary. Hopefully it will help transform our society. And perhaps Martin Luther King started from the outside in and Buddhism starts from the inside out. I don't know if that's true, but it's a simplistic way of seeing it. Maybe they meet on the streets in the protests against injustice. I hope that's the case. Martin Luther King is supposed to have said or wrote, "An individual has not started living until he or she can rise above the narrow confines of individualistic concerns to the broader concerns of humanity." And so that also expresses some inner change. You know, how do you change your view of yourself and the world so your life is not only focused about your individualistic concerns, but somehow your vision is wide enough, your heart is big enough, that the concerns of your neighbors, of your city, of your nation, of the world is also part of your scope of what you look at and are concerned about. So the Buddha focused on freedom and the kind of the, you know, most kind of maybe essential freedom they did point to was the freedom from what he called tanha. And tanha is a Pali word, Buddhist word, that literally means thirst. And thirst I think of as a powerful word. You know, when you're thirsty, you know, just, you know, not only thirsty, kind of, you know, your mouth is thirsty for water, but, the, you know, we use it as a very powerful word, like the thirst for power, the thirst for money. You know, it's to be driven in a strong way. And so sometimes it's called craving, that, or translated in English as craving. And I sometimes think of the word as being almost synonymous with compulsion or drivenness. That when the mind is driven, when the mind is operating under compulsion, especially compulsion when something in our inner side of us gets contracted and tight and constricted, on fire or agitated, that we suffer. That comes with suffering. And part of the reason why we suffer is because of that compulsion, we can't just tell our minds or our hearts, "Please stop doing that. You know, that's enough now. You know, I've been angry at my sibling. I've been angry at my coworker. I've been angry at my boss for, you know, long enough now. It's been 5 years. And it's time to stop, please." You know, sometimes things fade away or sometimes things do change. But, you know, it's not so easy to drop things. Or sometimes the thirst sometimes that people have is better referred to as addiction. And we know that we have a society that's plenty of addiction in it. And addiction also is a compulsion that people can't stop, they can't let go of. And whether it's addiction to alcohol, or addiction to television, or addiction to fame, or it's a lot of things, addiction to entertainment, stimulation, always being busy, addiction to Facebook, addiction to, you know, violence. There's many things people are addicted to, they just can't kind of stop doing. And we see that, people who meditate, because I think meditation, I think, is very humbling. I hope it's humbling in a good way. If you're not humble yet, you're probably not been meditating. humble in the sense that you can't just, most people can't just say, you know, mind, stop thinking about that. You know, you might have success for half a second or a second, and there are times when it comes right back. It comes right back, and we can see, and maybe in a more subtle level, the operating of compulsion, addiction, craving, this thirsting. And this this thirsting is a source, the Buddha said, of suffering. Partly it's suffering itself, that contraction and constriction of it, but partly it's suffering because it leads to suffering. So that thirst or the addiction or the craving for power can cause a lot of suffering in oneself and also in the world around us. The craving for status. Then we want to be seen a certain way, and then maybe we're seen that way for a short while, and then something happens, our fortune changes, and we don't have our status anymore. And so that loss of identity becomes something very painful. So we cling to wanting things to be a certain way, and things turn out to be different. That clinging sometimes is referred to as rope burn. If you hold on too tight and the rope, you know, flies out, you burn your hand. So, you know, the first noble truth of Buddhism is a truth of rope burn. And because it's the truth of the suffering that comes when you're holding on tight. And so the second noble truth is that this has to do with this clinging or craving, this holding on tight, this compulsion. And the first noble truth is that if you do that, you'll get rope burn, heartburn, brain burn. The Buddha said then that, you know, this, that the craving is the cause of suffering. What's very interesting, I think, is that he did not use a pronoun to talk about the Four Noble Truths. He did not say, you have suffering, and your suffering comes from craving, or me, I suffer, and my suffering comes from craving. He just said that there's a truth of suffering. There is suffering in the world. There's also beauty and joy and delight, but there also is suffering. And there's also, and if you want to uproot that suffering, if you want to live a life free of suffering, you have to really understand the root causes of that suffering. And he said the root causes is the craving. But if a person has uprooted, has brought an end the compulsive qualities of the mind, the craving of the hearts, then that person does not have within him or herself the source, the seeds, the momentum to suffer. So, for example, if I don't, I'm teaching all of you right now, so to give back a very practical, immediate example. So if my identity is tied with all of you thinking that I'm a wonderful Dharma teacher, and I sit here and I don't make any sense. My wife once heard me give a Dharma talk once. And she told me afterwards, that didn't make any sense. So it has been known to happen. And if I'm clinging to having all of you think I'm a wonderful teacher and like me in all kinds of ways, and I give this disastrous talk, then I could suffer unduly. I mean, it's okay to feel regret, wasted all the people's time, it's unfortunate. And it's okay to feel a bit bad about that. But, you know, to have my identity, you know, clinging to, I have to be this kind of person that everyone has to see me this way, it's just a headache. Or clinging, there's all kinds of things people cling to. So, but if you don't cling, then that suffering is not going to happen in oneself. But this is the remarkable thing about the Four Noble Truths, one of the remarkable things. If a person is matured enough spiritually that they can live a life without clinging, without grasping, that person then will not be the cause of suffering for other people. And that is a phenomenal gift of someone who has matured in Buddhist practice. Because, if we look around the world, primarily the, when we see how much suffering humans cause to each other. And if you go behind the scenes, behind the eyes, into the heart of the people who cause suffering, I don't think you have to go very far to see craving of one form or the other. You find greed, you find hate, you find a certain kind of clinging that comes out of fear and that can cause harm to others. Comes out of conceit. It comes out of the clinging to these radical separation of self and others that judges others or pushes others away. Someone who doesn't cling doesn't have those things. And so, you know, they might do something accidentally that might hurt someone. But someone who's matured in this Buddhist spirituality will not be the source of suffering for other people. It doesn't mean, as I just said, that they're not the condition for the suffering. Came into the hall today, into the center today, and left my shoes in front of the door, not thoughtlessly, just, you know, threw them off at the door and I came in, and then some of you walked out the door and tripped over my shoes and fell and, you know, hurt your knee. You hurt. It was my accident. I wasn't paying attention to where I put my shoes, but I was partly the cause or the condition, condition for you hurting your knee. But if you suffer because of that, if in the Buddhist kind of analysis of suffering, how Buddhism defines suffering is not the inconvenience, it's not the physical pain of hurting your knee, the inconvenience of having to limp to work tomorrow or something. The suffering comes from the grasping, the clinging that your mind falls into as a result of that event. So some people might grasp on and cling to blame. Some people might cling to the sense of being a victim. Some people might cling to their sense of identity. It's how embarrassing. I just practiced mindfulness for 45 minutes and then I didn't notice the shoes. I tripped. Boy, I'm a mindfulness failure. And I can, I should never go back to IMC. Or I'm going to take up skiing where they have big ski boots or something. But the idea that the clinging, the grasping, is something that comes from the person who does it. And this is part of the very, I think, very challenging and sometimes for some people very offending teachings of Buddhism. The way in which Buddhism emphasizes that we're responsible for our own suffering. And it takes a tremendous amount of courage and strength to be willing to turn around and look deeply at ourselves and be able to kind of see what our responsibility is for our suffering. It doesn't exempt people outside for their responsibility. I'm still responsible for having put my shoes there, and I need to apologize or make some amends perhaps, but I'm not responsible for the suffering that arose out of it. So, to say that is a delicate thing to say because people hurt so much. Some people have such tremendous deep suffering that has really its clear genesis in terrible things other people have done to them. And to kind of point to their wound and say, well, you're responsible for that wound. Just put salt in the wound. But this is what Buddhism is pointing us towards. And at times to go and tend to that wound and see how can we relate to it in such a way that we can become free. Free from our clinging, free from our grasping, free from the way we tighten up or freeze up or close down or numb out. How can we become set our heart free? How can we open up? And so that's really, one of the primary tasks of Buddhism. And the Four Noble Truths really points to that. So the Four Noble Truths are the truth of suffering. There is suffering in the world. The truth of the cause of suffering, which, as I've said, is craving. And then the truth of the possibility of ending that suffering through the cessation of that craving. And this is really the good news of Buddhism, even though it's said in a way that, it's not poetic or inspiring. it says that if in that craving, the craving that produces suffering, that craving can be brought to an end. And when that craving comes to an end, the suffering that comes from that craving can also end as well. You know, it doesn't. It's not a little statement that is, you know, full of rejoicing and happiness and delight and peace in itself. It's just kind of like a technical statement. But that's really what it's pointing to. It's pointing to a possibility that in Buddhism is called Mahasukha, great happiness. Great happiness of a Buddha is the happiness of having ended the movements of the heart, the addictions of the heart, of the mind, ended the clingings, the grasping. And what the great audacious claim of Buddhism is that it can be done completely. It can be done in many ways. It can be done in stages, and certainly can lessen the craving and grasping. But it can also be done completely. And so then, but it's not an easy thing to do. And so this is where the preparation is important, where the practice is important. And so the people who have a vision of the possibility of that freedom and the value of that freedom, then become interested in what does it take? There are some people who expect it to be instantaneous, to be quick, the quick approach, sudden enlightenment. I think the more realistic thing is the slow and steady path of growth and development. It might have its quick moments, sudden moments, but the slow and steady engagement in a path of practice that we walk. And the traditional, you know, the wording in the old days was to walk the path. So to a steady, ongoing walk. And for, you know, and it's really, I think it's a lifetime kind of path to walk on. And so this is a path that helps us with this process of coming to an end of clinging. And so it's a path of having right vision. It's called, the word is right, that's often used in these eightfold steps. And the word right, people react to the word right, but it has the same meaning of the word right as when you say that you have the right tool for the job. Say you have a carpentry job and, you know, you need a right tool. You know, you need a saw. You don't need a measuring stick. And so, you know, you need the right saw for it to actually do the job. If you want to, so it's, you know, in that sense, it's right. It's the appropriate. It's the one. It's the appropriate task. It's the appropriate activity for the purpose of coming to an end to suffering. So the first is the right vision. And so, to have a vision of a possibility, to have a vision or insight into or an intuition of freedom, to have a vision to see and to have a view, a way of seeing, a perspective, where we begin looking at our life through the perspective of the Four Noble Truths. And it's and I think the reason for this, why the Buddha formulated this way, is he was in some ways very efficient. He wanted to have the clearest, most direct route to freedom, independent of the kind of complexities that can arise when you have religious metaphysics, when you have bring in supernatural beliefs, when you bring in beliefs that cannot be proved, beliefs which are in some ways authoritarian, you know, where some tradition says this is the truth and the only truth. The Buddha, you know, didn't present a path that required that kind of belief, or required a kind of authoritarian kind of obligation to a tradition or a teachings or whatever. But rather he pointed to the most direct, non-metaphysical, non-supernatural pointing to something which in a sense is very ordinary. And something I'm sure all of you in your life have experienced and know in particular certain situations. You probably, all of you have seen how you've suffered, and how that suffering came because of what you're holding on to. And there's probably been a few times in your life where you saw that this is not worth it, and you've let go. And in that felt the relief of that suffering. I mean, even my little kids know how to do that, occasionally. And so the direct route is to have this vision, to have this understanding. This is what we're about. and not getting sidetracked by a lot of other metaphysical beliefs, ideas we don't understand or can't believe or can't understand, supernatural things. There's deities have no role in Buddhism. I mean, there is a kind of deity. Buddhism has deities, all kinds of deities, but they have no essential role for this, for the path of practice. And so the Buddha was pointing something very simple, but then the implications of it are quite profound and challenging when you realize how deep you can go. And then the next, so that's right vision, right view, and then there's right intention, to have the right aspiration or intention, to have the right kind of sense of purpose for what my life is about, what I'm trying to do. And I think one of the profound, really profound treasures in everybody's, in every human being, is the intention or purpose which they set their life to be about. And I think it's really a profound thing to reflect deeply about what a person's most profound or most significant intention they have around which they want to organize their life. And many people don't spend that time to really consider that. They just kind of follow along with what society, family tells them, or the direction that society gives them, or too many people don't have even the opportunity to think that, ask that question of themselves, because they're struggling to just cope, get by in life. But to ask deeply, you know, what is my deepest intention? And to have an intention that supports us in this, I think, beautiful path of freedom, freedom from suffering. And then, you know, it's not going to come free, freedom. It requires taking an honest assessment of how we live our lives, and then beginning to live a life that is in harmony with the freedom we want. Or live a life that's in harmony with living undriven, unaddicted, not craving, not caught up in greed, hate, delusion. And so what are those ways of living that we have to start living? So one of the ways is being careful with our speech. So the third step of the Eightfold Path is right speech. So start paying attention to how we speak and not speak lies. Chances are that if you lie, for the most part, 99% of the time, I'm sure, of lies, it's motivated by greed or hate, or fear. So it's some kind of clinging, some kind of thing we're stuck on. And so to start training ourselves not to lie is a training to move towards freedom and away from not being free. And then there is right action. So not only speech, but also how we act in the world. And so we try to act in the world so we don't cause harm in the world. We don't steal. We don't engage in sexual misconduct that can cause harm. We don't engage in drugs and alcohol that, you know, can make people do things they later regret. And so, because all of those things, chances are that if you engage in them, chances are that you're in bondage by something. Chances are that you're caught by some forces within you. It's not easy to see how we're caught, because sometimes we're very quick to feel the impulse to act in ways that can, and somehow feel that we're justified in it. Feel that what comes from me, it's deep inside, and, you know, I know what's right. But really, we're kind of caught in the vice of greed, hate, delusion, fear, many times. And so start acting in the world in ways that is in harmony with being free. Not acting neurotically, according to the precepts. Buddhist morality, Buddhist ethics, is not meant to be kind of puritanical, because then it just replaces one form of clinging with something else. But to begin exploring our actions, seeing how can I come from a place of freedom inside rather than from a place of being caught. And then there is right livelihood. So this is for many people, it's a big part of their life, their livelihood, how they get their livelihood. And then to have a livelihood also that's in harmony with the movements towards freedom. And to have I like to think of it as have a livelihood which doesn't express, you know, your greed, hate, delusion, fear, but also doesn't harm other people, doesn't limit other people's freedom, doesn't put other people in bondage, cause other people to suffer. It's a beautiful thing to be concerned with right livelihood, but not an easy thing. given how complicated and interconnected our society and works are. And then the last steps of the Eightfold Path really have to do with this turning now inward into the heart or the mind. And this is where meditation becomes really important, that the meditation allows us to develop the sensitivity, the clarity, the stillness, the calm, that allows us to see clearly what's actually motivating us, what makes us tick, what makes the inner life work, why we say what we say, why we do what we do in a deep, deep way. And to understand the subtle, which can also mean the strongest, clingings, graspings, fears, hates, greeds, desires that we have inside. And that takes a lot of, again, courage and stillness to sit still and see it all. But it also comes along with touching into some of the most beautiful aspects of the human heart and mind. Meditation opens the door to phenomenal experience of joy, of peace, of well-being, of wholeness, of integration, of peace, of insight, of wisdom. And it's quite something to do this path that's supposed to lead us to this inner freedom that leads us to these beautiful, beautiful, some of the most beautiful qualities of the human heart are right there to be found and developed and cultivated and discovered. And so these last steps of the Eightfold Path is right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And so that, in shorthand, it's usually focused on this inner development, focusing within. And so one of the things that happens with this inner development is that as we begin releasing and letting go of how we're contracted or clinging or closed or preoccupied, is that we become more sensitive, more awake, more aware of the beautiful qualities within us. But also it comes with us a greater awareness, a heightened sensitivity and awareness to the world around us as well. And it comes with a heightened sensitivity to the suffering that is in our world. And you don't have to go very far to encounter a lot of it. And it's, for some people it's a little bit awkward initially to start having kind of the crust of the heart, the self-preoccupation, the strong sense of us and the, me versus you, us versus them, that kind of can keep the channels of communication, the channels of empathy from operating beautifully, cleanly. Sometimes it can seem like it's too much. We experience suffering around it too much. But generally, when people feel like they're experiencing suffering too much, it's like overwhelmed by the suffering in the world, it's because that suffering is touching places inside of us where we're still stuck, still clinging. If we're not clinging, then we feel the experience of suffering quite strongly, but it washes right through, or it doesn't stick anywhere. And then my hope, my belief, my confidence is that if you can do that, if you can be such a person who has freed yourself of clinging and able to share with the world, the suffering of the world, then I think that we start, we have the capacity of being a gift to this world. Whether it's a gift and support to our neighbor who's struggling, or whether it's marching in the streets, whether it's trying to do something about the poverty in our country or in the world, whether it's, there's a whole range of things a person might do. But it's really my hope that the people who engage in Buddhist practice will some point in the course of that practice, some point, become bright lights for the world, and some point live their life in some ways to make a difference, wider difference in this world that we live in. That Buddhism is not meant for us to kind of become enlightened hermits, but rather to become someone who becomes, we take our light with us into the world and try to make a difference in some way. And my hope is that the freedom that Buddhism brings an individual allows us to do that work in the world, whatever way it might be, with joy and delight. That it becomes something that's easy to do because it just feels like it comes from the fullness and the wholeness or the warmth that we have in our hearts. If Buddhism has, you know, one of the things I associate Buddhism with mostly, not mostly, but one thing I associate in terms of, you know, working in the world, making a difference in the world, I think of Buddhism as operating person to person, more than person to political policy. And so the warmth of our hearts translates to the warmth in our hands. And so the idea of Buddhism is, or freedom, or compassion, or, you know, this wonder, this little light that we have, it can be transmitted warm hand to warm hand, one person to another. And so as you go about, as you get up from meditation, as you go about in your world, you might consider the warm hand to warm hand. What is it that's conveyed from you that goes out into this world? And may your hands, your metaphorical hands, be warm and supportive and helpful to you and to all beings. May all beings be happy. So, thank you.